Someone in the back boomed out that I was an American pragmatist. And I knew that it was an insult from the tone of voice. But then we had to break to get the conference photo, and I never got back to him. And this troubled me for some long period of time. What could he have meant that I was an American pragmatist? And then luckily one day I was at a yard sale, two pieces of luck, and at the yard sale there was a copy of Martin Gardner's book from which I took the previous quote, called The Whys of a Philosophical Scrivener. And the first, it was a book of nothing but chapter one was why I believe this, and chapter two is why I believe that, and so forth. And chapter one was why I am not a solipsist. And I read chapter one, and I thought, okay, good, we're in agreement. Chapter two was why I am not a pragmatist. And I had my chance to figure out what it was to be an American pragmatist. And as I read the chapter, I thought, I am a pragmatist. The guy is right. Gardner, not much anymore. And the thing that really came out in that article was, as I was reading it, I thought, oh, he wouldn't say this if he understood quantum mechanics a little better. He wouldn't say that if he understood quantum mechanics a little better, and so forth. And in the end, I thought, I really am a pragmatist. So, well, that's right. That's right. He also does that. So, knowing Abner's love of Charles Sanders Peirce, I thought I would give some kind of mention to Peirce in this talk. He was being the founder of American pragmatism. But in the end, as I started thinking about the content that I wanted to go through, I decided to simply call it the Quantum Bayesians and not Peirce, James, and the Quantum Bayesians. Those of you with some knowledge of pragmatism, like Abner, will see the pragmatism infused throughout the talk, and probably in the end, I really had no need to talk of Peirce and James anyway. The flavor of pragmatism that I think you'll see is William James and John Dewey, and not so much Charles Peirce, but it'll be in there. The quantum Bayesians. What is this thing called quantum Bayesianism, and who are these quantum Bayesians? Quantum Bayesianism, if it's really a subject, is something not, or at least to some extent, akin to what you heard from Anton Zeilinger yesterday. It has its roots in Copenhagen-ish ideas. On the other hand, it's not exactly the same sort of thing as Anton was talking about yesterday. I realized in his talk, is he here? Maybe he's not here. He's not up there. I ended up thinking, after hearing the end of his talk, that he makes the quantum Bayesians look like old-fashioned realists in comparison. Quantum Bayesians, well, there's been a whole lot, I don't know if you call this list a whole lot, but there have been a few more papers than this, of very good quality papers lately that have some very meaty results. And if you want to hear something meaty rather than fluff, like you're going to hear in my talk, you should go to some of these papers. They're starting to develop the formalism enough that one may now say, it's not that we look at the quantum mechanical formalism and from that derive an interpretation. Instead, they're turning it around. We have what we think of as a tentative interpretation, and what we would like to do is get the formalism out from the earlier ideas. So what I want to do today, mostly, is not so much tell you about any of these results, really. They're great things. I should be careful here, being at the Perimeter Institute. Rob Speckens is in this list, but I'm sure he would say he's no Bayesian. On the other hand, his results are so important for the program, I couldn't not put them in. What I'd like to do is convey some of the mindset of this view so that you sort of get enough of a feel for it that you continue to think it's silly, or maybe you think that there's something to it. In particular, I'd like to go back to this quote that I hope you guys were reading when you walked in, this one from Martin Gardner. What does it say? The hypothesis that there is an external world not dependent on human minds, made of something, is so obviously useful and so strongly confirmed by experience down through the ages that we can say without exaggerating that it is better confirmed than any other empirical hypothesis. The thing that I'd like to show you is that despite first appearances, this quantum Bayesian program is not antithetical to this. And in fact, it very much would like to fall into this category and try to say something about what the something is. It'll just do it in a roundabout way. Anton, you missed my remarks on you. So what's a good starting point? I'm just going to take this as a starting point. That is to start discussing measurement at the outset. In the laboratory, people like Anton Zeilinger and Nicolas Chassin and Alain Espe build devices. And at least conceptually, they put quantum systems into these devices. And when they combine the two ingredients, kind of like chemists, when they combine the two ingredients, something new comes about. One of the pointer takes a value. In the formal description of quantum mechanics, we take all of the complexity of all of that laboratory work and we squeeze it into a simple description, that a measurement corresponds to a Hermitian operator, or another way of saying it is that measurement corresponds to an orthogonal basis in some dimensional vector space. So this is a theoretical description of something that really happens out in the world. One of the main conundrums of quantum mechanics is that one can ask this kind of question. It seems one is forced to ask this kind of question about that process called measurement. Does it reveal a pre-existing but unknown value, or rather, does it in some sense go toward creating the very value? So in this picture, in the way I'm going to draw it, in the theoretical description, we have a basis. Maybe you should think of it as uncolored at first. And through the course of measurement, it picks up a coloring. One of the basis vector becomes red, signifying that this is the outcome, and the other two green, signifying that they're not the outcome. Is there some way to get a handle, or at least start to make progress on these questions? Is it the case that measurement is just revealing a pre-existing but unknown value, or rather is it something about a value being created in the process? Historically, the starting point for addressing that question was this one, the EPR criterion of reality, which I've modified to suit my taste. If without in any way disturbing a system, one can gather the information required to predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity, the value of a physical quantity then there exists, you guys can read it. Then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. I think that's a decent definition. It gives you some kind of criterion for the idea that the value was already there. If there's something you can do on the outside world, not to the system itself, and be able to infer what you're going to find over there, then you get the feeling, well, it was already there. That's why I was able to infer it. But, you know, we all know the troubles with this. Just consider two spatially separated cutrets in some maximally entangled states. So these little black boxes are the cutrets. And let me explicitly assume locality. That's an assumption that I like to make over and over. The reason being, if I had not assumed locality, it strikes me as being difficult or perhaps impossible to analyze the universe into parts like we are accustomed to doing. when we would come along and interact with the system, we might think, oh, we're asking such and such question of it, or we're making such and such measurement of it. But if the world were non-local, then it pretty much takes away the meaningfulness of this idea that we're asking a particular question to this piece of the universe, because the answer we'll get will depend upon things unboundedly far away. So I'm going to assume locality. Now I'll measure the left one of these qubits, any way you like, say with two non-commuting observables. Is this thing called measurement simple revelation, after all? Well, if you make a measurement of one of the observables and you get a click, then you know that you get click number two, you know that you can walk to the other one and you'll find click number two. You can predict it with probability one. If, on the other hand, you had measured a different observable and you get click number two here, you know that you can walk to the other one and you'll get click number two there with probability one. So by this EPR criterion of reality, it should be the case that those values were preexistent, they were already there, and measurements doing nothing but revealing them. Well, that would be nice if you could stop there. But there's all kinds of sets of observables that you can consider. And a convenient one to think about, a convenient set to think about, come from this nice picture by Asher Peres, where he took the center of a cube and then connected it to the black dots out there. This set of rays has a remarkable property that if you complete it, if you take these 33 rays and you add enough extra rays to make 40 triads, I think the total is 57 rays, and I believe the way you can do it is just take an initial set and then rotate some, and then rotate some, and then rotate some. And after about 90-something rotations, you'll end up with 40 triads. And the remarkable property of this set is that there is simply no way to color every orthogonal triple green, green, and red. There's just no assignment of the value. So you have to go back and think about this. EPR criterion of reality said, if I do this, then I can predict this with certainty, therefore it is there, therefore it is preexistent. That needs to be rethought, it seems to me, as long as you're assuming locality. So I think the main lesson of all of that is that quantum measurements are generative. Their outcomes do not preexist before the measurement interaction. They arise from the very process. So in this list of quantum Bayesians, if you ask what is one thing that they all seem to accept, it's a statement of this variety, that measurement helps bring about the value that's found. Now, what you saw was part of the story of EPR. Einstein himself never laid too much credibility to that argument. This comes from a letter that he wrote Schrodinger. For reasons of language, this paper was written by Podolsky after much discussion. Still, it did not come out as well as I had originally wanted. Rather, the essential thing was, so to speak, smothered by the formalism. Well, if the EPR paper didn't quite give what he wanted, what was he seeking? The best thing that I've ever seen comes from the Schilp volume, where Einstein writes an autobiography. And at the end of the volume, he has a reply to critics. And he gives his version, not of the EPR argument, but a slightly different argument. And it's the best that I've ever seen, because it breaks up the problem in a way that I hadn't seen anywhere else in his writings. He considers two kinds of physicists, a physicist A and a physicist B. A physicist A is one who believes that measurement outcomes preexist the process of measurement. And then he argues that for physicist A, quantum mechanics is necessarily incomplete. But then he turns his attention to physicist B, the one who is willing to believe that measurement outcomes come into existence through the process of measurement. And then he tries to argue that quantum mechanics is still incomplete. And here's the argument. So here's what he granted. He took the point of view of physicist B. The individual system before measurement has no definite value Q or P. The value of the measurement only arises in cooperation with the unique probability which is given to it in view of the psi function only through the act of measurement itself. So he's taking the point of view that measurement outcomes come into existence with the process. Now, he considers two spatially separated systems like we did a while ago that has some entangled quantum state, psi 1, 2. And now here's his own words again. Now it appears to me that one may speak of the real factual situation at S2. On one supposition, we should, in my opinion, hold absolutely fast. The real factual situation of the system S2 is independent of what is done with S1. According to the type of measurement which I make of S1, I get, however, a very different psi 2 for S2. For the same real situation of S2, it is possible, therefore, to find, according to one's choice, different types of psi function. If now physicist B, that's the one who's accepted this, accepts this consideration as valid, then he will have to give up his position that the psi function constitutes a complete description of a real factual situation. For in this case, it would be impossible that two different types of psi function could be coordinated with the identical factual situation at S2. So I think that's a very clean argument, and I like it a lot. So here's a quantum system. And associated with that quantum system is the perfectly reasonable point of view that there's some real factual situation about it. That's what he's saying. On the other hand, when we as physicists write down this symbol, this argument of his, assuming locality, of course, argues that the symbol does not refer to the real factual situation. This, I think, is another thing that these quantum Bayesians would accept. So there was the first point, that measurements are generative. The second thing is that this psi is not an expression of a real factual situation, but rather someone's information. Or a dramatic way of saying it is that this thing, this symbol, if it's a property of anything at all, it's a property of the knowing subject, of the agent, of the observer. Now, that's one argument that one can give for the point of view that this represents information about what? It's information about this. Nevertheless, it's possessed by me. There's a whole slew of other arguments. And I think that it's worthwhile to go through the exercise of thinking about ducks. The story being that if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And if you do genetic testing on it and you find that it has the genome of a duck, it's very likely to be a duck. So let me just give you some examples of this sort of thing. Let's think about the things that we think make quantum information unique. For instance, we all know about this. We know about the no cloning theorem. Suppose you want a device that takes a quantum state and a piece of tape in a standard quantum state and makes two copies of the initial quantum state. It just psi I tensor S to psi I tensor psi I, regardless of the value of I. So you've got, let's say, two possible quantum states that you would like to clone. You want to build a device that will do that. Well, you know that you can't build it if the inner product of these two possibilities up here, psi 0 and psi 1, if that inner product is strictly between 0 and 1, then you can't build a cloning device. And the reason you can't is because of unitarity. The initial inner product of those two possibilities is this. The final inner product is the first value squared. There's no unitary evolution that will do it. And in fact, there's no completely positive map on a larger Hilbert space that would do that sort of thing either. Actually, how uniquely quantum mechanical is that statement? Or is it a case of this thing looking like a duck? Well, Let's ask a really ridiculous question. Can you clone a belief? What do I mean by that? Well, think of this situation. There's two pendulums up there. I wish I could see things here. There's two pendula up there. One of them is motionless. You can read motionless. The other one is swinging back and forth. It has some coordinate variable. It has some momentum. For some reason, I put a vector symbol over the momentum, but it's just a scalar quantity. And imagine that there is an observer outside of that system, and for whatever reason, he has limited knowledge about the position and momenta of this first pendulum. He captures his limited knowledge by some probability distribution on the phase space. Now imagine I'm out here. This is me, the underlined I. And I say, I know enough about him to know that he's either describing his knowledge or beliefs with the probability distribution P0, or he's describing it with the probability distribution P1. I myself don't know which one he's describing it with. Is there anything that I can do, any kind of interaction that I can make between the two pendula that will, at the end of the day, cause me to write down PI, P0, P0 for the two systems, or P1, P1 for the two systems? Is there anything that I can do short of reading his mind? Well, that looks like cloning. So what I'm trying to do is clone the probability distribution. Well, if the overlaps of the probability distributions, the two possibilities, is strictly between 0 and 1, then I cannot do it. And the reason I cannot do it is because Liouville evolution is phase-based volume preserving. Consequently, it's overlap preserving. And the process of cloning, just like it would have been quantum mechanically, requires me to open up the inner products between these probability distributions. So that's an example of the quantum state. We said, oh, here's a unique property of quantum states. They can't be cloned. But if we turn our attention not to actual states, physical states of systems, but rather degrees of belief about systems, we see that it has the same property as quantum states. It can't be cloned. Let's look at something more difficult. Teleportation, quantum teleportation. There's surely something extremely unique about that. We all know the story of teleportation. Charlie hands off a quantum state to Alice, some quantum state there. Alice and Bob happen to share a singlet state. We just simply take the overall wave function, write it in a very nice form, and we notice that if Alice performs a Bell basis measurement on these two particles, then it projects Bob's state into one of these four possibilities. And if Alice were to send him the result of her measurement, then he could simply adjust for the possibilities and return the initial state that Charlie created. Is that such a truly unique quantum mechanical process? Or is it another example of duckism? Well, let's consider an example, again, about beliefs. Not states of reality, but states of belief, states of expectation or information. Here's what I have. I've got three boxes, a big fat brick wall in between. I've got Alice and Bob just like I had before. They have a telephone line running between them. But these are black boxes now. They're not quantum systems. And in the black boxes is a coin. In each box is a coin. And the coin is either with its head up or its tail up. Now, tail, that's weird. Coins shouldn't have their tail up. Okay, and now here's what I'd like to do. Remember Charlie in the quantum teleportation case. He was the person who prepared the quantum state. Let's talk about Charlie now as simply having some partial knowledge about the value of the coin in here, whether it's head or tail. He captures his partial knowledge by writing down some probability distribution for heads, the probability distribution for tails, and is characterized by some real number, x. Suppose he also believes that there's perfect correlation between Alice and Bob's coins. He just doesn't know what the perfect correlation is. So his probability for head on Alice, head on Bob, is equal to his probability for tail on Alice, tail on Bob, is equal to 1/2. Now suppose the operations that Alice can do is somehow, by whatever means, she can learn about the parity of the coins in these two boxes, but she can learn nothing more than that. So she can learn the parity. And in the process of learning parity, she just possibly interchanges the boxes, but we don't know whether she did or not. On the other hand, what can Bob do? Let's assume that he can turn the coin over in his box. He can't look in, but he can turn it over. Let's teleport. Alice checks the parity. Okay, so Charlie hands off his box, about which he has some partial knowledge, characterized by the number X, hands it off to Alice. Alice checks the parity of these two, and she announces the result to Bob. Bob says, ah, if it's odd parity, I'll flip my coin. If it's even parity, he does nothing. The upshot of the whole process is, if we consider what's happened according to Charlie's perspective, he started with a probability distribution for the value of the coin in this box, and he ended up with exactly the same probability distribution for the value of the coin in that box. In other words, Charlie's knowledge was transferred from being about this box to being about that box. No, it's not destroyed. As far as Alice is concerned, since these two are possibly randomized by her parity checking, she still doesn't know what's in this box. So she may still have a uniform distribution over heads and tails for that box. Bob didn't know anything about the heads or tails in the box to begin with. He just knows that he flipped it. So if he had a uniform distribution over those outcomes, he still has a uniform distribution. As long as you're talking about degrees of belief and not the states of reality, then this, I think, looks exactly identical to, not exactly, it's one bit different. Alice and Bob only had to communicate one bit, not two bits. But otherwise, it looks the same as teleportation. If for some reason you had the stubborn belief that the real value X somehow instantaneously flew to Bob, then indeed it would look paradoxical. But since it's only about belief, don't ask too many questions, Dave. I got a lot. It's not so weird. So the lesson of this sort of game, I think, has been best done by Rob Speckens in this paper, where he considers something that he calls his toy theory. And he shows, so the toy theory is a local hidden variable theory. But what's really interesting about it is not that he tries to, and it's not meant to be quantum mechanics at all, it's meant to be a toy theory. But what's really interesting about it is he shows that in case after case after case, if you focus on the states of incomplete knowledge and you look at their properties, you will find so many properties that you find in quantum mechanics. You'll find non-commutivity of measurements, how things change. You'll find, I like this one, monogamy of entanglement. You know, of course, he doesn't have entanglement. He's got correlation. But in this model, he has monogamy of correlation. With no cloning, like we've already talked about. He also recovers this thing that we call no broadcasting theorem that we thought was truly uniquely quantum mechanical. It's not. And the conclusion that he draws is that the diversity and quality of these analogies provide compelling evidence for the view that quantum states are states of knowledge rather than states of reality, and that maximal knowledge is incomplete knowledge. So none of these, of course, are definitive arguments, but it seems to show that the weight of the evidence is against you if you want to view the quantum state as an actual property of systems. It is a much more natural interpretation to view it as incomplete knowledge, simply because you get all of these properties back. So here we are. I think we're in a situation where we are probably, if we're somewhat open-minded, compelled to view a quantum state as being simply incomplete knowledge. Between going from the classical coin toss cases that I was talking about and the quantum mechanical cases, it's not that somehow probabilities become more objective or more reified. Instead, what changes is that it's always about knowledge. It's just in the classical case, the knowledge is knowledge of states of reality, states, some kind of pre-existent reality. And in the quantum case, the character of this variable that your beliefs are about changes. Now, this move is often considered dangerous, to sort of insert the observer in such an rude way, insert the observer in such a gross way, in such a blatant way. And I think that no one has said it better than Avner Shimoni at the conference in Vienna last year for Anton Zeilinger, when Shimoni was speaking, and I noticed that he turned his eyes to me as he read from memory. They went to sea in a sieve, they did. In a sieve they went to sea, in spite of all their friends could say, on a winter's morn, on a stormy day, in a sieve they went to sea. And when the sieve turned round and round, and everyone cried, "You'll all be drowned," they called aloud, "Our sieve ain't big, but we don't care a button, we don't care a fig, in a sieve we'll go to sea." Well, the fear is that if you insert the observer in such a gross way, you give up on some hope of saying that physics is about reality. And perhaps physics is a branch of psychology. That's the fear of going to sieve in a sea, going to sea in a sieve. Oh, at the time I told Abner, you see, the way to make a sieve float is to just take a very thin piece of cellophane and put it on the bottom. And it doesn't take much. But if you have just a sliver of cellophane, you can make a sieve float. And similarly, in this Bayesian view, if you have just a sliver of reality somewhere in the picture, it should still float. Here's the way Pauli put the fear. And this is probably too small for you guys to read. I'm going to read it, though, at length, because I think it contains such an important idea. He said, "Einstein and I often discussed these questions, and I invariably profited very greatly, even when I could not agree with Einstein's views. Physics is, after all, the description of reality," he said to me, continuing with a sarcastic glance in my direction. "Or should I perhaps say physics is the description of what one merely imagines?" This question clearly shows Einstein's concern that the objective character of physics might be lost through a theory of the type of quantum mechanics, in that as a consequence of its wider conception of objectivity, of an explanation of nature, the difference between physical reality and dream or hallucination become blurred. The objectivity of physics is, however, fully ensured in quantum mechanics in the following sense. Although in principle, according to the theory, it is in general only the statistics of series of experiments that is determined by laws, the observer is unable, even in the unpredictable single case, to influence the result of his observation, as for example, the response of a counter at a particular instant of time. Further, personal qualities of the observer do not come into the theory in any way. The observation can be made by objective registering apparatus, the results of which are objectively available for anyone's inspection. Just as in the theory of relativity, a group of mathematical transformations connects all possible coordinate systems, so in quantum mechanics, a group of mathematical transformations connects the possible experimental arrangements. Einstein, however, advocated a narrower form of the reality concept. Well, this intrigues me. He comes out and he says, we're not giving up on reality. What we're doing is adopting a larger notion of reality than you, Einstein, are. It's not at all giving up on it. And if you want to see that there's still some reality in the picture, then all you have to do is look at your inability to, you can't will the measurement outcome that you want. You set up the device, and then it surprises you with an answer. It's not in your control. This is a point that Anton Zeilinger emphasizes a lot, that the measurement click is beyond your control. And if you're looking for some evidence of reality, it's right there. Anytime you get kicked, you're reminded that there's a real world out there. So that's 2 points. Let me read a little bit more from him. It seems to me appropriate to call the conceptual description of nature in classical physics, which Einstein so wishes to retain, the ideal of the detached observer. To put it drastically, the observer has, according to this ideal, to disappear entirely in a discrete manner as a hidden spectator, never as actor, nature being left alone in a predetermined course of events, independent of the way in which the phenomena are observed. Like the moon has a definite position, Einstein said to me last winter, whether or not we look at the moon, the same must also hold for the atomic objects, as there is no sharp distinction possible between these and macroscopic objects. Observation cannot create an element of reality like a position. There must be something contained in the complete description of physical reality which corresponds to the possibility of observing a position already before the observation has been actually made. It is this kind of postulate which I call the ideal of the detached observer. In quantum mechanics, on the contrary, an observation changes in general the state of the observed system in a way not contained in the mathematically formulated laws, which only apply to the time dependence of the state of a closed system. I think here on the passage to a new phenomenon by observation, which is taken into account by the so-called reduction of the wave packets. As it is allowed, this is an important sentence, as it is allowed to consider the instruments of observation as a kind of prolongation of the sense organs of the observer, I consider the impredictable change of the state by a single observation to be an abandonment of the idea of the isolation or detachment of the observer from the course of physical events outside himself. So in this slide, there's a couple of lessons that I think it's worthwhile taking to heart. One, as we've already discussed, the image of observation in quantum mechanics shouldn't properly be viewed like that, that the observer is separated from what he's looking at by a big, thick plate of glass, and the stuff that he's looking at is so far away that it can only affect him, and him never affect it. The other one is this point that I like very much, that Pauli says, as it is allowed to consider the instruments of observation as a kind of prolongation of the sense organs of the observer, I consider blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, everyone likes to talk about decoherence, and they want to think that somehow making a separation between the apparatus and the measuring device and the observer and then throwing in some extra environment is somehow going to do something for you. That, it seems to me, is ignoring that the fundamental problem is really one at an ontological, epistemological level, how to draw the cut between the two things, and is, as they say, pissing in the wind. The picture that comes out of this point of view of Pauli's, and now we get back to these silly quantum Bayesians, I think, is that we should stop thinking of the measurement process as asking a question to nature and then letting it reveal an answer to us. Instead, I think a more accurate picture of the whole thing is to think of a measurement, or a positive operator valued measure more generally, as an action. A POVM is an action that one can take on a system. So here's the agent, here's the system. When the observer takes an action on the system, it leads to a reaction in himself. He has a sensation. By the way, this picture is effectively copied from John Wheeler, too, who pointed out that the way of thinking of observation is more properly to put the measurement devices in place of the hands. He definitely followed this Paulian idea. So here's the picture. You don't get a measurement unless there's an observer and there's an external world. You can never forget about the external world. If there weren't an external world, then there wouldn't be a measurement. There wouldn't be anything to take an action upon. On the other hand, when you've got this thing out here, it causes some kind of reaction in the observer. He says, ouch. Ouch in a certain way. In other words, he got outcome D. This thing called the quantum state represents his expectations for which outcome he will get. And that's all it does. What is quantum mechanics about? These Bayesians would say it's mostly, almost all, about what's on the inside of the purple line. Except for this registration D, this random thing that he can't control, which presumably is a fact. Some value has come into existence. Except for that, quantum mechanics is about how to update his degrees of belief and how to manipulate his degrees of belief, how to make them consistent, and so forth. Now, this is a kind of weird notion of measurement, because one would normally think that if you give up the idea that measurement is asking a question of nature, then what on earth are you doing it for? There's a quantum system out there, and this thing called measurement is just basically a kick of it. There's no great use in a kick, is there? Well, I think that's wrongheaded, too. And I think probably the best place that we can look in our own field for how useful a good kick can be is captured by the Rausendorf and Bruegel model of quantum computation. In their model of quantum computation, there's no unitary time evolution at all. There's just a big array of quantum systems. And the computation takes place by starting with some particular privileged state of information about this whole lot of quantum systems, something called a cluster state. And when one wants to do a computation, say factor a large number, then the first thing they do is get out a classical computer and write a little subroutine on the classical computer that tells them what to do. It tells them to go to the first qubit, let's say here, and kick it in a certain way, and then notice what outcome it gives. And they punch that into the classical computer. And it says, go to the next qubit and kick it in a possibly different way. And then notice what reaction it gives you. And then you punch that into the computer. So you kick this guy. It keeps giving you reactions. And all the while, you're punching the reactions into a classical computer. And at the end of the day, the classical computer has factored the large number more efficiently than it could have if you hadn't been kicking the quantum systems. So here you've given up on the notion that measurement is revealing something. And yet, it's still useful to be kicking these quantum systems. So that's one point. The next point that I'd like to make, and then I want to get to some slightly more technical results, is the obvious reaction, and I don't blame you, is to say, if that's all quantum mechanics is about, it's about the stuff in the purple, how can it possibly be saying anything about the real world at all? This is Jeff Hellman's reaction, for instance, in his talk the other day. It seems to give up on the enterprise of physics. Seems to. Well, let me give the best story that I know at the moment for how one might think that it gives you a little more than that. It's a story of a Bayesian who's an inveterate gambler. He can't stop himself. And gambler, he can't stop himself. And the society he lives in and the two penal colonies that they have for gamblers. When you gamble too much, they either send you to the island of Prozac prescriptions or they send you to the island of emotional roller coasters. So what was it about this gambler? He gambled on everything. He gambled at the casinos. He gambled on his life every day. And this was a funny fellow. He would even gamble on his emotions. So, for instance, this guy would wake up every morning, and he would ask himself, am I going to be happy or sad or angry by the end of the day? And then he would mark a little point on a probability simplex to represent to what extent he believed that he was going to be the one or the other or the other. So he'd write down a little probability vector, and the property of probability vectors is that all the terms are greater than zero, and they sum up to one. This was one of his habits. And then he had all these other horrible ones that got him into great debt and so forth. So So he was finally convicted, and he was sent to one of the penal colonies. He was sent either to the island of Prozac prescriptions, I'm not sure why, or he was sent to the island of emotional roller coasters. They probably had it populated with old girlfriends or boyfriends. So here's what I'd like to ask. Suppose that after 20 years, the guy is finally released from the penal colony and his gambling habits have been eradicated. Most of them. All of his bad gambling habits were eradicated. But while he was there, he continued this habit of gambling on whether he was going to be happy, angry, or sad. What I'd like to know is, can we look at the record of his gambling of that situation and figure out, or at least make a good guess, of which penal colony he was on? Well, if you think about it, if he was on the island of Prozac prescriptions, each and every day he'd probably say, well, I'm going to run into some quack doctor and get a prescription today, and at the end of the day, I'm quite likely going to be happy. If I wake up angry, more than likely by the end of the day I'm going to be happy. If I wake up sad, by the end of the day I'm going to be happy. If I'm happy, yeah, I'm going to be happy. On the other hand, if he had been sent to the island of emotional roller coasters, he never knows where he's going to be. He might wake up angry and become happy by the end of the day. He might wake up happy and become sad by the end of the day. So notice the difference between these two pictures. In the one case, the points cluster near the top, and in the other case, they cluster somewhere in the middle. 20 years have passed by, and luckily he's left us a record. That was how he ended up gambling, most days. And so we can ask ourselves, can we figure out which island he was probably on? It seems to be clustered toward the center and not so much near the edges. So it appears that he was probably on the island of emotional roller coasters. Here's what I think is interesting, at least about this example. Look, the points are so sharp. Maybe I should have put a little spread out here, but the points are so sharp that we can effectively bound off a region and say that that region tells us something. What's the lesson of this whole thing? Well, the lesson is that his probabilities, the way he was gambling, if you're Bayesian, are states of belief. What are they states of belief about? Well, in this case, they're not even states of belief about the world, but states of belief about the gambling agent himself. He's writing down probabilities, he's writing down his beliefs about his later emotions or his later sensations. And you would think that there couldn't possibly be any trace of saying something about the world in these two things. On the other hand, you've noticed that the region does give direct information about which world he lives in. So you look at the probability assignments, even though they refer to him, they're totally and completely, they're completely about himself, but there's something structural about them that says something about the objective properties of the world. Well, it would be really nice if we could look at quantum mechanics in such a way as to elicit a picture of that flavor. If we had some way of writing quantum states, now I've just hit my time limit, but I'm going to go a little bit longer and then take questions. It would be nice if we could find some way of writing quantum states, let's say as probability distributions, and end up with a picture like that, like the one of the islands, where we could look at some structural element within the whole affair and say, it's not the particular values of the probabilities that's indicating something about the world, but rather something more akin to the shape of this region that we were just talking about. Well, there is a way of writing quantum mechanics that way, and it simply takes introducing a special observable. So for any quantum system, let's say a Hilbert space of dimension D, you imagine fixing a very particular observable that's so special to you that you'd put it into the Bureau of Standards, just like you have the standard kilogram and the standard meter stick. And in place of quantum states now, what we'll do is insert a probability distribution. The probability distribution represents the agents, the observers, degrees of belief about which click will occur in this Bureau of Standards if he were to take his quantum system up to the Bureau of Standards. Is there any observable that will do that? Yeah, there is. You can do it with a single observable if you don't focus on standard quantum measurements, but rather go to positive operator valued measures, POVMs. There's an extra freedom in the POVMs in that you don't require that the operators be orthogonal to each other. They need not be commuting. Well, that helps you. It helps you because if you have a Hilbert space of dimension D, the space of operators is of dimension D squared. And if you have dropped this requirement on measurement operators, then you can contemplate choosing a set of operators that are also a basis for the vector space of operators. So here it is. The quantum states form a D squared dimensional vector space. If you choose D squared linearly independent E sub H's, these are operators in the POVM, then you can just notice that the probabilities for the outcomes given by the Born rule completely specify the quantum state. The reason they do is because the Born rule is really an inner product. It's the inner product between this vector up here in this space and this vector, which is also in the same space. So if you can find any such measurement with that property, that the elements are linearly independent and there are d squared of them, then you can choose it as your standard. And when you do, the representation of a quantum state becomes a point on some appropriate dimensional simplex. So let me skip the technical development of the talk and give you roughly the final answer. That prescription gives you a one-to-one map between quantum states and probability distributions, but it doesn't give you an onto map. In fact, it defines a region in the space of the simplex that's not so very different. Well, what does it tell you? If you do this kind of prescription, every point within a certain region represents a quantum state. Every point on the outside doesn't represent a quantum state. So this is like in the analogy before. We find that when we gamble, we use all of the stuff in here, not out here, for measurement devices. If you choose the measurement nicely enough, with enough symmetry, then you can give a direct expression for quantum states in terms of the probability distributions for the outcomes of these measurements. And moreover, you can end up with an equation for the state space. You can end up with an equation for that region. The probabilities have to sum to one. Their squares also have to sum to a certain number. And then there's a very complicated relation that they all have to also satisfy. In quantum states, the full set of quantum states is the convex hull of these three equations. I didn't write the normalization one on there. The lovely thing is that these coefficients in here are effectively structure coefficients for the whole algebra. So if one can give a story that defines this region, it's independent of quantum mechanics, it's independent of invoking operators, then what this tells you is you can take these numbers and develop a representation theorem that says it's useful to use operators when describing quantum systems. And you can take these as the structure coefficients for the algebra. Now, the hope of the quantum Bayesians, at least some of them, is that when this project is complete, you'll be able to look at this region and finally answer the question of which island we live on. It encodes some information about the world as it is, independent of observers. And that's what we've all been seeking all the time. We shouldn't get sidetracked by what we think is reasonable that the wave function represents knowledge. Thanks. Yes. Because of objective chance. Let's see if I have a reaction. I will try to have a reaction. It seems to me that when one focuses solely on wave functions, or perhaps on chances, as I think you're suggesting, one is throwing away a lot of possibilities to begin with. For instance, in classical physics, suppose you had two bodies with some gravitational attraction between them, and there's some orbit. You could write down what's happening in a phase space picture, and you end up with some x and p, and that's the point. Or if you worked in a Liouville distribution, a Liouville picture, you could write down a probability density for these things. And it seems to me the fixation has been in only thinking of those two things as the possible objective properties of the system. But I would say, oh, there's a whole lot of other things. There's the fact that this is a 1 over r squared force between the two of them. It corresponds to the specification of some Hamiltonian, say. From it you derive a Hamiltonian. So you might say the Hamiltonian is an objective property of the system. Another thing that you might say is an objective property of the system are the two masses. So M and M are objective properties. The only thing that is being dropped in this quantum Bayesian picture is that the XP and the P of XP are objective properties. What's still holding is something akin to this. When you look at this system, you might say it has a certain Hamiltonian. And that Hamiltonian is its objective property. It's the one that it has even when I'm not interacting with it. Or you might say that the Hilbert space, the algebra of operators that I have ascribed to it, its dimensionality, that's the objective property it has even when I'm not interacting with it. So it's not giving up on everything. It's only giving up on some things as objective properties. We know your religion. Indeed. So the nature of religion is that one holds, generally, to one's faith in spite of all the evidence that piles up against them. I wish I knew the Bible better. I could tell the story of the poor fellow who was tortured. Job, wasn't it? Job, the Lord punished him and punished him and punished him, and yet he believed in the Lord. So there's experimental evidence. One can do experiments, and one has some preconceived notion, and if the experiment keeps contradicting the experimentalist, the experimentalist, I think, usually changes his mind. He adjusts to the evidence. There's also theoretical evidence. It strikes me, this is why I love this paper by Speckens so much, because it seems like it hammers you over the head with example after example after example of how incomplete states of knowledge behave like quantum states. And if you just ignore that, then that does smell of religion. So I'm glad you called it your religion. Yeah. Fair enough. Oh, no, that's a good point. I tend to be sloppier in talks than I should be, mostly because I don't want everyone's mind stopping constantly and saying, oh, you know. So it is antithetical. So in this picture, in fact, we were talking about randomness the other day, and I said, I believe in ultimate randomness too. Just like you do. But I think it has to be explained in epistemic terms. And the epistemic terms, for instance, that one could say is, look at this diagram. If it were a classical world, then if you had started for whatever experiment you might perform, be it that experiments aren't well defined, as Scholz would say, but for whatever experiment you wanted to perform, what you could do is, in principle, go out and test different pieces of the world, and before performing the actual experiment, you might push your certainty further and further and further and further until you're absolutely certain of the outcome. In this picture, it says, if you've adopted quantum mechanics, what you are accepting already is that there's nothing you can do that will sharpen your predictions beyond this boundary. So implicit in that is you're saying the world is constructed in such a way that I can never gather enough information. And effectively, it just doesn't exist. So one starts now speaking of, one should properly speak of probabilities, not as lack of information. But it may be something a little more Bayesian and just say probability represents uncertainty for whatever reason the uncertainty came about. In the classical world, the uncertainty came about because you didn't work hard enough, or there's some limitations to you. And in the quantum case, you're stuck with uncertainty, but you're stuck with uncertainty because even the world itself doesn't know what outcome it's going to give until you interact with it. I only said two sentences about it. That was my cheap move. That's I'm sorry.